This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Property Show on The Morning Run, our weekly take on everything property related. Khazanah Research Institute has recently published a report entitled Rethinking Housing Between State, Market and Society. Now, this report examines the policy environment of the housing sector in pursuit of policies that matters to homeowners, property developers and contractors, financial institutions and government agencies. Last week, in part one, I discussed with Dr. Surai Ismail, the Director of Research at Khazanah Research Institute, on affordable housing. Today, in part two, we will be looking into the supply and demand mismatch, the standard of an affordable home, as well as the option of renting as a solution. Now, you can catch the full conversation of part one on our BFM app or download it on Spotify. Dr. Suraya, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.
Dr. Suraya, let's pick up where we left off. We saw a significant drop in home units valued at 250,000 ringgit and below beginning the year 2008. What is the reason for this decline in the number of affordable homes?
We saw a marked increase in properties of 250,000 to 500,000, 500,000 to 1 million, and properties more than 1 million. So basically, the industry shifted straight away into more expensive products. So this was basically, there's a lot of factors that has contributed to this, one of which was when the policy of having houses that cost more than 1 million for my second home policies. There are also some reason to believe that there's a correlation between the DEEP scheme as well as property developers wanting to ensure that they have products that will give them higher returns. So this was the 2008 year that saw that everything going up the other side. At the same time, this was the time when the RPGT was lax as well. So we saw a lot of composition of residential properties launch being pegged or being signaled by the transacted prices of a lot of flipping activities happening then.
So we've heard about the factors, but during that period, what happened to those who were not able to afford to buy properties? What were their living arrangements?
We don't have the figure of number of residential renters at the level that we think is accurate. Mm. There are numbers, but that's not. We believe that more should be done to get more accurate numbers. So we believe some has moved into the rental market. But at the same time, a lot of issues are still not clear because we've never done a proper housing need analysis, meaning we don't know whether people are living like two families in one house. We're not sure whether they're living in a substandard type of housing because in our census, we never had what we call a proper housing need analysis.
Okay. Now, looking at the trend of price increase of up to 22%, could you elaborate on the implications of rapid price increase in properties?
One of the issue of rapid price escalation is that, which it happened 2009 and above, it went up really high, as you mentioned just now. Mm. Had we gone on the trajectory that we did prior to that, it would have just been at a CAGR 3.1%, had we gone to that normal trajectory. And house prices would go up, but at a level that will not create artificial price hikes. Artificial price hikes backed by finance will only create a bubble, because once you need to sell it back or at a time when everything needs to be monetized, when it might happen, the value of the house will not be at the value where you can sell back the house. Mm. So that's one peril of rapid price escalation. The other thing about rapid price escalation is basically people can't afford to buy it because our income will not be rising as rapidly. So these two factors are the things that created the problems we have now. So 2009, now is 2019. It's been 10 years. It's been left unchecked. So one of the reasons we wanted to ensure that this is done in a market way is that we have to ensure more stock comes in at the right pricing. That's okay. Why we wanted the median multiple tree. So when more houses come in at the right pricing, the rate of increase will flatten.
And what were some of the recommendations from this report which could help bring down the price of properties?
So this is one strategy, and it's not something we just thought of. Mm. It's been used in other countries as well. The original objective, if you remember just now, was to look at how other markets have survived rapid price escalation and what did they do. First, they never do credit easing.
Okay.
Two, if there is a mismatch in demand and supply, you must let the market dictate, meaning if those house prices, unsold stock, needs to go down, not 10%, but 30%, well, then if you want to get it sold, that's what the prices should be.
Yeah.
Because in the first place, it was artificially inflated. So we were trying to rectify things here. And the third thing is one of the move of the government, which is to flood the market at the right time, at the right location, with affordable houses. Because then in and of itself will bring incoming stock down. And as you know, secondary market will then slowly look at this. Let's not talk just about the rosy things. Mm. There's also the downfall of these strategies, that those people who bought their houses at 2011, 2013, when it was rapid price escalation, their equity will go down. That will surely happen. And it is happening now. We've been looking at the secondary market.
So let's move on to another subject. You spoke about credit easing by banks. Now, in relation to that, the Minister of Finance has recently come out with a directive to banks to help facilitate home ownership, which is again a call for credit easing. Now, what is your take on that announcement?
I can't speak for the government,
sure.
But we always say that home prices should be affordable first before financing could make it ostensibly affordable. I think that's the answer.
Okay. So you spoke about asset accumulation in your report, and 75% of Malaysians still subscribe to the idea of home ownership. Now, are Malaysians worse off if they go for the alternative, which is renting of homes?
Okay, this is such a loaded question.
Okay,
so I'll break it up a bit.
Sure.
First of all, some statistics. So we have home ownership rates for the country, as you rightly mentioned, 72.5% back in 2010. So I'm really looking forward for the 2020 census. However, if you look at the proper breakdown of urban and rural, so basically urban ownership is 69.1% and rural ownership is 81.2%. So basically this figure is up because of the rural composition. Mm. So look at a state like Kuala Lumpur, which is 100% urban. The total home ownership is only 53.5%. Mm. So that means there are people who are renting in cities. Now, the next question is, are we better off renting or are we better off owning? That depends a lot on city-making initiatives. Why do we live in certain cities and towns? Because they give us job opportunities. Now, if we think all of us are stuck here in KL, we can't move to anywhere else, and therefore we will think that the best thing for us to do is to buy a house in KL or Greater KL, because this is where we'll end up working. Irrespective of if we change jobs, it will still be in Kuala Lumpur. So, scarce resources, but everybody's coming here. Mm. So, KL as a city that thrives will have its structural problems, such as everybody's coming here. Now, if we free up Kuala Lumpur, if one can say that I could have a job opportunity in Johor Bahru, I could have equally a wonderful quality of life in Georgetown, Penang, then renting becomes feasible, even for someone who's in their 20s, 30s and 40s, because there's flexibility to move around cities and towns. It makes sense to then have flexibility. But if you don't have that, and that's why in other most other countries where their towns and cities are quite competitive in terms of generating the income and the jobs that are meant for the young ones, as well as people in their 30s and 40s, renting is a viable option. But if all of us are stuck in KL and there's no other job opportunities, first, of course, we'll rent for a while because we don't have enough money for deposit in our 20s, 30s. By 40, we want to buy a house.
Okay, so it hinges on the fact that we need several cities in Malaysia that are able to provide similar lifestyle options. I guess my follow-up question would be, how can the government promote the concept of renting amongst Malaysians, and can it be a viable solution to our affordable housing woes?
Yes, and one of the things that we have to look into is the condition of the rental properties as well as the terms and conditions between landlord and tenant. Because people who rent also want rental security. Mm. You can't have a 2+1 contract, but after the 2 years, it goes up 30%. It has happened to some of we have seen evidence of that. And yet there's no place for us to bring that forward to say that, look, you can't be increasing my rent 30% after 2 years for the plus one. That's number one. Number two, renting must be affordable too. So we have a ratio for this, whereby what is the income to what is the rent ratio, the affordable rent ratio? It should be about 25%. So if you're paying more than that, I think you should think twice and rent another place.
Okay, so two things. Consumer protection as well as control in rental prices. Do we have existing frameworks that can accommodate these concerns?
No, not yet. Not yet. I think the currently the National Housing Department, Jabatan Perumahan Negara, is thinking of coming out with one. So we don't have that yet. So I think that is why we always mention in our report, a government must provide the operating environment for rental or home ownership to be thriving. So this is one of the things that's missing, which is the Rental Act that protects both the landlord as well as the tenants.
Okay. So we'll have more on the property show after these messages. Stay with us, BFM 89.9. If you've just joined us, this is The Property Show. I'm Syarid Sabdullah and I'm speaking to Dr. Suraya Ismail, the Director of Research at Khazana Research Institute. Okay, Dr. Suraya, let's talk about the subject of housing standards for affordable homes. What are some of the findings that are available in this report regarding the subject and what does it suggest?
One of the things that we want to look at is basically understanding what good quality housing is in this country. And of course, after that, develop the good quality housing standard. The thing is, it's not been done yet. And the other issue about developing a good quality housing standard is that it must take into account standards of quality, standards of adequacy, for housing through a participatory process, meaning asking people what they want out of their houses, asking for the satisfaction level of the current houses they are residing in. And we also have to look into, take into account the cultural and societal norms of households. Therefore, the standard that we create will then not be divorced from how people are living in this country. So this needs to be done. After this is done, we can then talk about affordability. Mm. So in a way, this report has moved away from the only variable of affordability. But before that, we are looking into adequacy and suitability. If those two criteria are being satisfied and it's affordable, these people can purchase that house from the private sector. Now, if they can't afford it, and they fall within the eligibility criteria of, remember, the targeted assistance.
Sure.
So that goes to the social housing. So can you imagine one bright future maybe 5 years' time or 2 years' time, where people in social housing and people in apartments live in the same quality type of physical environment. One is sponsored by the government, one is run by the private sector. Now, if we are serious about having social mobility and any other things that we believe should be a social protection to the less fortunate of us in this country, then decent standards, good quality housing standard must also be given to them. We can't have PPR that is of substandard just because they're poor.
You know, that's a wonderful aspiration for us to have. However, taking into consideration the existing PPR housing that we have today, which is a legacy issue, how do you think we can improve their home structure?
This is a tricky question. So, again, I think a participatory model would be very good. We do need to ask the satisfaction level of people living there. And after that, we can then having once we have the standard up and running, we can compare the standards that they are living in now with that standard that we want everybody to have. So the next one is would be should we demolish this dilapidated building or should we refurbish it? Now that depends on a case by case basis lah. If it's too run down, then we might have to do something about it. But if it's still in a condition that we can just refurbish, it all depends on the financial coffers we have.
Sure.
I hope the brilliance of our civil engineers and architects to hopefully not design houses like that again. And hopefully then things will be better.
And we spoke about how we do not have a proper standard in place which describes a quality, affordable home. What are some of the suggestions that we can derive from your report regarding this subject?
One of the major issue about just looking into affordability is we miss out the good quality housing standard.
Yeah.
I think that's important for us to really look at. And good quality housing standard should be also located at good neighbourhood amenities. We're losing a lot of public spaces.
Sure.
And this is something we wrote a lot in the book, that we go into a developed country, we have thriving cities, but it appears that standard of living is not that great. So if we start from the home, shelter, and that is of good quality housing, at the same time affordable, and then the local community or amenities are of a certain standard, this is something that we aspire to have. However, it's not just about the government providing it and the private sector giving us those amenities. Society, too, need to take ownership of these facilities. More often than not, we see a lot of breakdown in playgrounds, in many public spaces, and that's because society don't take ownership of these public spaces. So this is the other thing that we wanted to impress upon our society, that we must collectively take charge of our local neighbourhood and make sure that we don't vandalize it, we take care of it. And I'm sure if we do this together, the three entities, we will get a good neighbourhood.
So speaking of ownership, has the government done enough engagement to educate the communities of their responsibilities and sense of ownership of these public spaces?
Wow, it depends on the neighbourhood that you're in. In terms of the laws, if you have a development beside you that will create congestion to your neighbourhood, you can demonstrate and participate to say that this is not what I want for my neighbourhood. I think there's already a channel or a method that you can contest any development in the structure plan or the local plan if it's gazetted.
Okay. On that note, you have been listening to The Property Show. Dr. Suraya, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to Dr. Suraya Ismail, the Director of Research at Khazanah Research Institute. Coming up next, we have the 10 a.m. news bulletin, followed by Enterprise. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.